Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 335th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I am a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia. Happy New Year, everyone.
Happy New Year. I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and a professor at the University of Alberta in the Department of Family Medicine.
Now, Mike, James. I think we need to come clean, if you will.
Okay.
We're not really recording this in the new year.
No, no. In fact, this was done in June.
Yes.
2015.
Yes. This podcast will be released in probably the first week of January. But as many of you probably have figured out, we occasionally record a number of them together. And it is Happy New Year when you're hearing it, but it's not Happy New Year when we put it together.
No, that's because I have chosen to disappear for a
extended period of time.
Yeah, right. So we have to record a few ahead of time.
Yeah. And so this episode, you will have just, the last one, if you'd been listening to it, was one on Santa.
Right.
And pardon me?
And before that was the first half of guidelines.
Yeah, of how to think about guidelines. And when we did that one on guidelines, we briefly went through, you know, what guidelines are supposed to be. We sort of talked about how guidelines are assessed, how to find them, and so on. And then right at the end of that podcast, we talked about, you know, some of the other people who have potential issues with guidelines. And then we also kind of, put together what we thought would be a perfect guideline, or we gave some statements about what we thought awesome guidelines would look like. And I think I'll just quickly run through those. We thought they'd be awesome if they were developed primarily by and definitely for the people that ultimately end up using them. And we laughed about that.
and cried a little bit.
Laughed in a crying sort of way. We thought would they be awesome if they were a credible synopsis of the best available evidence presented in a way that clinicians could easily access and interpret. And we wept some more. And then we outrightly bawled when we said that they allow patient values and preferences to be taken into account.
Right.
So those are the three things that we thought we'd look at. And now what we thought we would do is go over the evidence, if you will, and it's different types of evidence, but how evidence-based are clinical practice guidelines. Because I think this is kind of interesting. I don't know about you, Mike.
Yeah, no, this is fascinating stuff. And it speaks to, you know, the importance of this information speaks to the fact that it took us 2 years to cover this, 2016 and 2000, you know, here we are, 2017.
Yeah, so it's really almost a full year of nothing but talking about guidelines.
It's the same thing.
Yeah. So a number of people have gone back and looked at how evidence-based are the recommendations in guidelines. And the three that I could find, and I know you're familiar with these, Mike, is there was a group that looked at cardiology guidelines, infectious disease guidelines, and endocrinology guidelines. And they went through all the recommendations and identified what evidence level were they based on. And it wasn't, they didn't go look for the evidence. They just said, what evidence did the actual guidelines say they were using? And what was interesting was, if the highest level of evidence, which is typically based on randomized controlled trials, although it could be meta-analysis, it ranged anywhere from 6% of recommendations in endocrinology were based on RCTs up to 14% for infectious diseases, and cardiology was right in the middle of 11%. And I think when I show this to other people, people are quite surprised how low that number is.
This one doesn't concern it, I guess I wish it was higher, but we know that it's randomized controlled trials are hard to do and very costly, etc. It's the second number that concerns me.
Well, and we'll get there in just 1 minute, because and again, this is just speaking from experience. I've often gone back and looked at the RCTs that they reference in these guidelines. I'm ballparking this. About half the time, the study that they are referencing almost literally has nothing to do with that recommendation.
Well, yeah, there's a number of flaws that somewhat consistently occur. So what will happen is they will look at RCT evidence, let's say the risk of developing, they'll look at the population over a time in a large trial, and they'll show how many people developed, let's say, diabetes in that time frame. And then they'll use that as RCT evidence, even though in the trial they're using it as a cohort study.
Exactly, yeah.
The data they've extracted is actually cohort data. It's not randomized data. It just happens that, yeah, it's cohort data taken from a randomized trial. And you'll see that's just one example of the mistakes that are made quite consistently.
Yeah. And I don't know if it's a mistake. I think it's purposeful.
Oh, listen to you. Usually you're the one that's filled with hope.
No, it's purposeful in that they are purposely finding something so that they can put a reference to it.
Yeah, but do you think that they don't understand the difference between? Do you think they know that they're using RCT data as cohort studies, or do you think that they actually know they're doing that, but they're going to say it's RCT to make their statement look stronger, or do you think they're just mistakenly interpreting
I would hope they are just sadly mistaken.
Okay. See, there you are. You're back to hope again.
There we go.
I think we get you there, James.
Yeah. Now your concern was, and I think, you know, we can put it into context, was the sort of, when we talk about the lowest level of evidence, we don't mean it's a low level of evidence, but the lowest level is recommendations that are based on opinion. And depending on, they range from a third to just a little bit over a half of all recommendations are based on opinion. Now, I think I think people would be surprised at that, and I think you were when you initially saw.
Yeah, I'm most disappointed with that. I'm disappointed that we would venture there to make recommendations, and I understand why we need to, but what I would like to see.
Well, I'm not correct you, but I'm going to say I understand why people have the need to. Mm-hmm. I don't think we necessarily need to.
Well. There are clinical questions out there that clinicians have on the front lines, mm-hmm. and certainly wouldn't mind guidance, even if it comes from expert opinion. Mm-hmm. My concern with that is, and I don't think there's necessarily, when there is no evidence, I don't mind people providing, for lack of a better word, guidance. But I don't want that to be turned into a performance measure or even to be considered something akin to gospel.
No, right. That's a very important context, I think.
Yeah. Like, I don't mind you saying, like, well, we don't have any evidence for this, but the group felt that this is probably the best way to proceed for most patients.
Mm-hmm.
But make it so that people don't feel obliged to follow that rule.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good way to think about it.
Yeah. So anyhow, that's my beef with these, is that they're unfortunately given with the same kind of strength and vigor that the 10% or so of guidelines or 10% of recommendations that have solid evidence or mm-hmm. somewhat solid evidence.
Yeah. And then there's a lot of people actually looked at these sorts of things. There was a group back in 2010 that looked at clinical practice guidelines over a period of a couple of decades, and there are ways of appraising them using different tools. And if you were to look at the top score was 100% for each one of these things. And it was stakeholder involvement, rigor of development, applicability, and editorial independence. And those are the things out of the AGREE tool that we talked about previously.
Yeah.
And this group, they looked at, I think, just over 600 different guidelines. And of those things that I just mentioned, stakeholder involvement, rigor of development, applicability, and editorial independence, the highest number of score out of 100 was 44%. And in cases of applicability, they were almost as low as 23%. So overall, the quality from a stakeholder or rigor of development is not encouraging.
No, it's not good. There were a few that were okay. Scope, purpose, clarity of presentation. Mm. Got almost two thirds, so 60, yeah. Or got just above that, two thirds, so 68%. But the vast majority were less than 50% scores.
Yeah, and they also suggested that there really haven't been any changes in the last number of years. And recently, I went back and looked at a number of other places where people had looked at guidelines, and these are individual researchers who've looked at the quality or rigor behind neuropathic pain guidelines, hypertension guidelines, asthma, diabetes, vancomycin, all sorts of different guidelines. And neuropathic pain had the highest, interestingly, as far as quality of rigor, and that was 55%.
Yep.
And it got down to as low as a couple of guidelines, not a couple of guidelines, a couple of assessment of a number of guidelines out of China where the quality rigor was around 8%.
Which that's not high, by the way, James.
I would even say that I would even break my rule of not using the word high and say that is not high.
Would you say it's low?
Yeah. No, I'm not going to go there. It's definitely not high. And the range was 55, 30, 32, 48, 20, and 18 for these different levels or different things that people were looking at. So I think it's important that people realize that that is where the evidence, the quality of the evidence that's in guidelines, and it's not necessarily the fault of the guideline writers. You can't really make up evidence. Well, actually you can, I guess. And I think some of these guidelines
done.
Yeah. And I think we talked about this on an earlier podcast, so I don't want to spend too much time going over it, but there was a really nice synopsis done by a couple of people that we know, Victor Montori being one of the main ones, where they looked at all of the type 2 diabetes evidence from sort of since 1998 of tight glycemic versus less tight glycemic control. And I think they very clearly showed that the evidence is exceedingly weak in that there is any necessarily benefit. But then they also showed how enthusiastic the guidelines were for that sort of information. And I don't want to spend too much time on it, but because we already talked about that on a previous podcast, but it is really interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. There's very little relationship between, particularly for microvascular, between what the recommendations are and what the opinions are, mm-hmm. and the actual evidence shows.
Yeah. Now I'm aware of, I think you described it once as one of the greatest articles ever written.
Yes.
I'm pretty sure you did. It was written by you, I think.
Well, that does sound like something I'd say. If so, it was written by me, I can see, yeah, me wholly endorsing it.
Yes. So that's a segue into the fact that Mike has actually looked at this a little bit and published stuff on it about who actually contributes to primary care guidelines.
It's funny because you say this because you know as well as I do that we've done a fair chunk of research in our time. Mm-hmm. And well, I think some of what I've done has made a contribution. I also am not beyond thinking that I've noticed that a lot of researchers put so much weight on their research, even when there may be 10 studies on a single topic, but the one they did is the one they think is definitive. And I'm definitely not like that. This study, what we did is we asked a different type of question, though. We asked who is actually writing clinical practice guidelines, and this was for Canada. And we focused on guidelines that were classified as primary care guidelines, and there are 176 of them in the CMA database, Canadian Medical Association. And we went through them painstakingly. We had two or three students working with us, and they did, or two students rather, and they did a great job. Ronnie Kraut, who's now in practice and doing some more research, and Avon Crayshaw. And the two of them did a great job. And Mike and Tina were involved, and Ben, who's the statistician that we often enlist. And we just wanted to find out who was writing these guidelines. And we found that 54% of the authors on guidelines overall were specialists for primary care. So they're writing guidelines for primary care. 17% were family physicians. 11% were other clinicians. 3%, a whopping 3%, James, were pharmacists.
I know, yeah.
And what's interesting is if there was industry funding involved, the number of family doctors dropped off further to 8%, and the number of specialists crept up to close to 70. So we talked earlier that the people who are writing them or the people who are using them should be the ones who are writing them.
Well, at least primarily involved. We're not. I don't think you or I would in any way, shape, or form say specialists should not be there.
No, I wouldn't say that. In fact, we can talk a little bit about the guideline we did work on, yeah. and how we did involve specialists. But I think that that it should be representative. Remember that 70% of all the care in Canada is delivered by family physicians. For all medical care, 70% is delivered by family physicians. And on our very own guidelines, we represent less than 1 in 5. Mm-hmm. And so it's a fascinating conundrum. Lots of reasons psychologically why this has occurred and all that kind of stuff. There's a certain sense among certain specialty groups that they own that disease area. So if they're an endocrinologist, they kind of own diabetes. Mm-hmm. And it's their thing to take care of and kind of set the standards for good care. We also found something else that's quite interesting was that 69% of guidelines in Canada have no place to even report conflict of interest.
Yeah, which is quite something.
When you're talking more than 2/3 of guidelines don't even have that as part, a statement that you could look up what the conflicts of interest are, it's concerning. It's not even that they're there. It's that we found that conflicts of interest were definitely, when they were presented, were more common among specialists. Not quite double, but close to double compared to family physicians, but still a concern. Yeah, it's just, we just wanted to point out that despite primary care delivering the majority of care, they're not really even on their own guidelines. They're not represented well.
Yeah. And another, clearly not nearly as good research has been done on this as well. And, a group looked at who was actually sponsoring the guidelines, which is different than who wrote them. Mm-hmm. And this is a group that looked at 2,300 guidelines, and this was back in 2009. They looked at who was involved in the development of them. And 41% were written by medical specialty societies. 22% were written by government agencies, 17% by professional associations, and 9% by disease-specific societies, and then 4% by independent expert panels. And their comment at the end of their paper was at least 2/3 are being developed by groups with a clear potential for important biases. Now, realizing that everybody has biases, but that was their sort of thing. And there's been other looks at this where looking at who has conflicts of interest, and the BMJ put something out about this in about 2011, suggesting that anywhere from 50 to 80% of panel members on guidelines have financial conflicts of interest. There are many other types of conflicts of interest, but financial were 50 to 80% of panel members. And because of these potential conflicts of interest, some people have gone and made statements that that's why we cannot trust clinical guidelines. I think that's going a little overboard, because just because you have a conflict of interest doesn't mean that they're necessarily bad, but it's certainly something we need to be aware of.
No, because it's not even, you know, we talked about the number of specialists on guidelines, but it doesn't end there, and it's not easy to tease out. But if you've had the good fortune to have sat on a number of guidelines, you will recognize very quickly that the way a number of the big national guidelines are done is that they will pick people who have a very specific interest that has relevance to that guideline. So if you can imagine something in the lipid realm, you would pick someone who has spent their life researching lipoproteins. Mm-hmm. And that person would be on the guideline. And when the question of should we be monitoring lipoproteins comes up, you can imagine which direction they would side.
It sounds like you have experience in this, Mike.
No, James. This is just all conjecture on my part. But you, and it's very interesting, having been on guideline where we're choosing people, the guideline chairs will very frequently gravitate towards picking these people. Mm-hmm. When it's talked about in the meetings that we should be picking people with very little stake in what's being done. We shouldn't pick people who spent their life researching these areas because they have too much predisposition bias.
Yeah.
And that's some of what you've already alluded to. And yet they almost always gravitate towards selecting those people. And that is why when you look at the guidelines and see how they deviate from the evidence and you scratch your head, how could this have occurred? These are some of the underpinnings of guidelines, that it isn't just financial conflicts of interest. It's not just receiving money from a given a drug company or mm-hmm. manufacturer. It's actually oftentimes more subtle than that.
Yeah. And in fact, I would suggest most of the times it's the more subtle part.
Oh yeah.
It's not
yeah.
so much the money. I mean, the money is easy to go after, but I think you're exactly right. And that's why some people have said to figure out what is going to be said in a guideline, just tell me who is on it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there, I can pretty much guarantee what they will say.
Yeah. There's an article entitled, clinical practice guidelines are too important to be left to experts.
That's a great line.
There are so many people out there, yelling into the wind mm-hmm. about these issues. And it's very, very slow to change. I think in Canada, we are seeing, as primary care doctors, we're being approached much more to be on national guidelines, or at least be a representative. Mm-hmm. But many of them, the diabetes guideline, for example, it is very hard to find. Even though there are over 200 pages to the guideline and multiple committees and like literally probably 100 people on that guideline, mm-hmm. it is hard to find a family doctor
yeah.
that is truly a family doctor
yeah.
that just does primary care, not where he specialized or he or she has specialized in diabetes.
And I think it's even worse if you put just a token one on.
It's sad then, and then you
can say, yeah, we had family practice involvement, and then you go, no, you didn't.
Yeah, and that poor family physician, even if they raise concerns, they're just overwhelmed
yeah.
because there may be 17 people on the committee, and even if there's one or two of you who go, but that doesn't make sense for primary care.
Not talking from personal experience.
No, again, this is just conjecture on my part.
So that's some of the issue of who writes them and sort of the financial conflicts of interest. And then an equally unbelievable researcher.
Yes.
Has looked at this as well. And it comes down to the issue of how well the guidelines address patient values and preferences. And so myself...
This work wouldn't be believable, but Peter Lowen was on it. So that's somewhat reassuring.
Who was the other guy?
I don't know. Yeah. Some... J.P. McCormack or McCormick
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
It's hard to pronounce it.
And it is hard to pronounce it if you've ever listened to me due to the introduction to most of these podcasts. Well, so we looked at, this was back in 2007 where we looked at the title of our article was Adding Value to Clinical Practice Guidelines. And we looked at all of the chronic disease state guidelines, if you will, five of them on blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose, and bone density. There was two that had to do with glucose, if I remember correctly. And there was a total of 197 pages and 90,000 words. And I think, Mike, you would agree with me. I know you would. I'm not saying everybody would. But blood pressure, cholesterol, glucose, and bone density, there's a huge values and preference thing around the decision process in that area.
Mm-hmm. Except cholesterol. We know everybody should have an LDL of 1.8 or lower.
That's true, yeah.
But otherwise, yeah.
Yeah. So 197 pages, 90,000 words. We were generous. We could pull 99 words out. So that was 0.1% of words had anything to do with patients' values and preferences. Which again, that is not a high number.
Not low. We won't go that far.
No.
Not high.
Yeah.
0.1% yeah. of content.
And we've done similar things just recently where we looked at the most recent guidelines out of the American Diabetes Association and the European Association for the Study of Diabetes. And they were entitled Patient-Centered Approach. That was the actual title of the diabetes guidelines. And when you do that, you would hope that you could go in there and get information on risk estimation, impact of treatment on risk and harms and so on. And we tried, Lord knows we tried.
And we're back to prayer again.
Yeah, we were back to prayer again. But we literally, no reasonable human could go into those guidelines and pull out how big the risk would be if you had type 2 diabetes, the impact of treatment. There was a nice table of harms, but there was no magnitude associated with it. So we wrote a very nice letter to them and And their response back was...
Now, you did address that Dear Dum-Dum.
Oh, do you think that had an impact on it?
I don't know.
Yeah. But their response, and it wasn't Dear Dum-Dum, it was, Dear, are you kidding me? No, we wrote... And you know, they were nice. They thanked us for our letter. And then they said... And these are important, two phrases that I think are really important. They agreed that shared decision-making is a valuable aspect of diabetes care, which is great. But then they added that process would be incredibly labor-intensive and would make the standards long and unwieldy.
And even though they titled it.
Yeah, yeah. So you kind of go, really? That's interesting that they would, you know, you're 113 pages. And I would suggest that both you and I are, you know, if you and I were given a couple of pages worth of material, we could come up with the vast majority of what you need to know to make decisions.
Yeah.
And then their final comment was, clinical guidelines are the foundation for evidence-based medicine.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but maybe I don't understand what foundation means, because shouldn't that be the other way around?
I'm not saying anything, because I just can't. I'm so annoyed.
I can't understand. I'm realizing why you had such trouble with that other study of yours, because you don't know what words mean. Exactly. So when you assess words that were relevant to patient values,
you
don't even understand what the word foundation means.
I know. It's
McCormick. Is that Judas McCormick?
Oh, God. Oh, some might find you funny.
Mostly me.
Yeah. And then we just, we didn't publish this. I just had a quick look at the most recent Canadian Hypertension Education Program guidelines, and they were just about 12,000 words, 20 pages, and tried to find mention of values and preferences. And again, it was 0.19% of the words.
Oh, they've doubled from 0.2.
And the statement was, practitioners are advised to consider patient preferences, values, and clinical factors when determining how to best apply these recommendations at the bedside. I mean, that talk about just sort of a throwaway statement.
And not to mention the fact that most hypertension care does not occur at a bedside.
Yeah, I wasn't going to add that, but I actually think they cut and pasted this from another guideline.
Probably yours.
Yeah.
Probably your article.
And then, but what was interesting, and they've done this a couple times in their guidelines, they've said, and it was about how you do risk assessment. They said, in the absence of Canadian data to determine the accuracy of risk calculations, avoid using absolute levels of risks to support treatment decisions, which almost makes it impossible to do shared decision-making. At least that's the way I would interpret it.
Given what we know about shared decision-making, and that patients find it far easier when they're told the risk without treatment and the risk with treatment.
Yeah. So it was just, there is a fundamental mind block for most people who write these guidelines. They are incapable, in my opinion, of really addressing values and preferences. It's been years and decades.
I think they are addressing their values.
Oh, yeah.
Anyway, let's keep the dream alive.
What's
next on the agenda here, James?
Well, there's a number of things, and I think some really exciting topics that we want to talk about. I'm trying to sell the next podcast, Mike. Because even though I think we said we were going to do two podcasts on, because Mike talks at unbelievable lengths about many things, we couldn't get to the end of all of them. So I think we'll shut this one down and let you know that we're going to talk a little bit about patients' expectations, the use of words in guidelines, and then we'll spend actually some time talking about the legal aspects of it, because I think there's some really important nuances that are associated with that. And then we'll hopefully, I think we will be able to wrap up in that last podcast what we really should do with sort of guidelines and how we can best do that and show you some examples. So you're okay with that, Mike?
Oh, sorry. Were you talking to me?
No, I wasn't. I was talking to the audience.
Okay.
I was talking to Mike, who's in the audience, but apparently he's not responding to this recorded thing.
Yes, I'm excited about it.
So I think, so why don't we leave it at that? We would, again, love it if you'd make comments on iTunes. We would love it if you'd go to our site and check out all of the tools and other podcasts that we create and the courses that are coming up. Our course in Vancouver, April 7th and 8th of 2017. We finalized the the list of speakers and the topics and so on, and that'll be coming out hopefully soon. But you know when it is, so don't worry about it. We've had a few requests for when are you going to get, let us know and sign up. But we'll get to that hopefully fairly soon. There will be more and more tools for practice coming out, obviously.
Yes. Yep. Lots coming out in the new year. Some stuff on do you need to wear sterile gloves when you're doing minor procedures? What about the GLP-1 analogs? What's the research on them?
Where do you need to wear pants when you're doing minor procedures?
Yeah, that is a topic that is best left for the college to discuss with you, James.
Again, could you imagine?
Again?
I thought by gloves they meant pants.
Sterile pants.
Yeah, latex ones.
And you look great on the dance floor in those, by the way.
Exactly. I have that full figure. So as most people know, when we get to this stage, there is even less value continuing to listen.
You thought it was impossible. Yeah. You're here with less value.
You know what? I now will use the word low. So I think we'll just leave it at that, as Mike has now lost all control of his laughter and bowels and everything. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.